Good evening, everybody. Thank you for joining me. You're listening to Sandy Seashore. This is the happy hour. I'm coming to you live from San Diego. We're here on Thursdays from 7 to 8 p.m., and I want to say a special hi to my friends in Palm Springs. Hi, Jeannie. Hi, Perry. And tonight it's a really good show because I have a diverse little lineup. I have Charlie Hill coming on, who is a pioneer at the Comedy Store. He's got such a long history. He's worked with Letterman, and he just knows all the history of the Comedy Store. And then at the bottom of the hour, I'm really proud to have a Dr. Boris Bagdasarov. He's got such a wonderful background in psychology and regression, and so we're really lucky to have him on the air tonight. But before we Charlie and Dr. Bagdasarov comes on the air, we have Tommy here. He's the talent coordinator for the Comedy Store on Sunset. Tommy.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Great. Doing great.
Sounds like a great show.
Yeah, definitely. Every week, huh?
Yeah.
So, you know, tonight it's the holiday rush is on.
That's right.
And everybody's kind of shifting into the holiday.
They are. We had good shows down in La Jolla last weekend and up here in Sunset. Some people were definitely coming out for some comedy.
Yeah, Harry Basil was down for the weekend. I went and saw the show.
Right.
And he looks exactly the same.
Right.
And he does this physical humor. He does all these takes on the movies and stuff. So I've always enjoyed him. But anyway, so last week was Thanksgiving, and I heard, and I know my mom and brother went to the Palms restaurant, both my brothers.
That's right.
And Jay Leno was there.
Oh, yeah, Jay Leno was there, and he and your mom took a picture together. Scotty was showing it to all of us.
Oh, they took pictures.
And Alfred, who works with your mom, he says, oh, I saw Jay Leno. He's looking at the opera dinner.
So, yeah.
Jay was fascinated to see your mom. It had been a while since he'd seen her.
What, probably like 10 years at least, probably.
Something like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So they had there was a lot of history there as far as, you know, comic and nurture. She really gave him a place to perform all through the mid and early 70s.
Let's talk about Charlie Hill for a few minutes.
Yeah.
Can you tell me, you know, let everybody know,
Well, Charlie Hill's been with your mom here probably since 73. He may correct me on that. Or maybe he was even a 72.
He's an Indian.
He's an Indian.
Comedy.
He did very well in comedy. He was on the Richard Pryor show. He actually had some small parts on the Bionic Woman and stuff because he dated Lindsay Wagner for years.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm. And but he was he's very funny. He was I've looked through the Vegas pictures. He's in all your mom's shows, and he has a great memory. He remembers a little bit of everything, but he doesn't remember it in some kind of a dictational style. He says it comedically with fun, the way a story from the store should be, right?
Yep. And he was down this weekend performing with Harry Basil.
No, yeah, he was down here this past weekend. That's right.
Right. Who's coming up this weekend?
This weekend is also, you know, really is like a real professional type show. Got Sean Pawlowski opening. She's been on David Letterman. She's been overseas a couple times. She's actually one of your mom's strongest female comics here. And then we have Jeff Altman.
Wow.
You know, Jeff Altman's going to be down there. And gosh, he was also on the David Letterman show earlier this year. He's from David's class. He's been in lots of movies. He's great. And then Barry Diamond, who's in the same kind of a boat like with Jeff, been in a lot of movies, is headlined a lot of clubs, done Vegas, does stuff like that. So it's a real professional show. It's good.
Did the guys return from the Middle East yet?
They're still over there.
Wow.
Selling out shows like crazy. They're having to add shows wherever they go.
And then that's in those new islands that.
Well, it's not just Dubai. They went to Saudi Arabia. They've been to a lot of places.
Oh, my dog has something to add, too.
That's right.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to getting him on the air to find out what's going on there.
I'm saving him two dates in January for Ahmed. He'll be back here in about the middle of December, and then he'll let me know what his schedule is. He's been filming a lot of movies, too. He just did Adam Sandler's movie, and he's got a kind of a up front, you can see him a lot part in Iron Man coming out soon.
So, you know? His career is really taking off.
It's all coming together. He's right the right age. He's been at comedy now for like 9 years, and he's 36 years old.
And by the way, that's about how long it takes everyone. When you see these comics in their comedy specials on TV, it didn't happen just overnight. It's been years and years in the making.
That's right.
And you know, with Vicki Barbalak, you know, she won Funniest Mom in America, and it took her, about 8 years?
Yep.
So, I mean, that's the reality of it.
It just takes time, but it's not that they have to wait around for their gig during all that time. You get gigs, you grow, you just find yourself at the end of that amount of time going, wow, mm-hmm. I'm so much better now than when I started.
So what do you have in the works? What's going project-wise? Is there anything you can talk about?
Well, you know, we're planning New Year's Eve right now. We got the confirmed headliner for La Jolla, and that's Al Madrigal.
Oh, great.
And Al's getting ready to come out in the show, a mid-season replacement with Raquel Welch. I couldn't tell you. He's told me the name. I've forgotten it. But he's coming out with a really key part in that. Plus, he's a huge national headliner. He has a half-hour HBO special, half-hour Comedy Central special. He's on The Tonight Show. He's been on David Letterman's show. He's on everything. And he's like, you know, he's like exactly what we were saying. He's like right in the middle, the group that's breaking. He's about 34, 35 years old.
And this is for the La Jolla show? Or
La
the
Jolla New Year's Eve.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And then
we're open 365 days a year. And for anyone that doesn't know, the Comedy Store is located on Sunset Boulevard in West Hollywood, and then we have a Comedy Store in San Diego.
That's right.
And it started in 1972.
As a matter of fact, you know what I was doing earlier, Sandy, as I was reading the article in the Los Angeles Magazine that was written about comedy and how it was formed in the 70s, and really where the Comedy Store played into it, it brought really into a well-written thing about your dad and Mr. DeLuca and your mom and how it all came into play, and then it's just a lot of really interesting things, and it's right there, and it doesn't...
Yeah, that really began the comedy revolution in the U.S. I'm thrilled about the Middle East. I'm thrilled about it so much.
I'm thrilled about it, too.
No idea, because that's the beginning of healing.
Yeah, well, your mom said that she was going to try to... She said her one of her greater missions in life is you have to heal the world with laughter.
Absolutely, it is the best.
You know.
So, okay, we're going to get Charlie Hill on the line.
Cool.
And, you know, if there's anything you want to say, like, oh, and by the way, everyone's coming to San Diego for the holidays, my family.
Wonderful.
So, you know, my dad lives in Las Vegas. My brother's back east and with his family, and everybody's converging here. So guess where they're all coming?
That's great, Sandy.
To my house.
That's wonderful.
So, that's a lot of extra work.
It is.
I'm looking forward to it.
Sandy's got the most beautiful niece and nephew, don't you?
Yes, Lola Rose and Caleb.
Oh, my goodness.
He's 5 and Caleb's 3.
By Sandy's brother, Peter, who's the what we call the psychologically well-adjusted shore.
Right. And then, you know, I have a collie dog, so I sent her Lassie reruns. So now I've got her hooked into collies.
That's great.
All kids have, you know, they need to see Lassie, I think.
Yes, they do.
Because she's going to get a Lassie dog one day herself. So we're gonna bring Charlie Hill on and check in with him, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks a lot, Sandy.
Okay, thanks, Tommy.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye. Hey, that was Tommy, the talent coordinator for the Comedy Store on Sunset. He does the show lineups with my mother. He works putting the shows together, which is a daunting job every week. They sit there on Mondays and put their lineups together. And it really does take a talent to do that. And Charlie Hill coming up, he's really one of the pioneers. And he was always a little different. He, you know, he's got a background of, with David Letterman and Jeff Altman and the people we were mentioning earlier. So I'm going to have to hang up the phone because we have to get Charlie on the line. Charlie, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Oh, my God, there you are. Okay, well, Seth's doing a great job at BBS.
Yeah, apparently.
He got you right on the line. What did I leave out with your introduction?
I didn't hear it. I just came in right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I was just talking about your diverse background with your history of working with some of the great comedians.
Oh, yeah.
And you live up in Los Angeles.
Yep.
And could you tell me, you've been with the Comedy Store since what year?
I came here in 1975, and I remember auditioning. I was in line with Michael Keaton and Letterman, and Michael Keaton was Mike Douglas at the time.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and David had a longer hair, and he had a beard, and he wore his glasses and a lumberjack shirt.
He had a street apartment on Sunset Strip.
Yeah, I remember that. That came a little while later. He lived in the Valley originally, and then sometimes he'd pick me up, and we would go in his truck and then play to chairs late at night.
Did you when you first started, did you just sit down and write a bunch of jokes and just go up and perform? I mean, how did you do that?
In my case, it was a long process because about a year or so earlier, I was in New York as an actor, and I would watch comedians, and I'd sit back and ask questions and take notes. And even before that, I was in radio, and I always collected jokes. So when I collected them, I inadvertently taught myself how to write them. All the jokes seemed the same that most guys were doing. So all the beatnik jokes were now hippie jokes, and the alcohol jokes were now pot jokes, but they were the same kind of jokes.
Remember one of your earliest jokes, your corniest jokes?
Let's see. Well, I used to open up with, hi, how are you? Hi, how are you?
I know, that's what I did when I saw you this weekend. One, hi, how are you?
Scotty always does that, too. That's always funny, because just the folks that were around remember that. And then since then, I've heard it on Family Guy, The Simpsons. I've heard it on sitcoms over the years, but I think that's pretty funny, you know. And it always got a laugh, and it broke the ice when I came out. And the first bit I did, it was a parody of old comics and old Indian stereotypes. So I had a character called Henny Youngblood, and I'd go up there with a drum, and I would tell one-liners. And they necessarily weren't all Indian jokes. It just one joke didn't have anything to do with the next. And with one-liners, it's not the jokes, it's how many you have. So it's just ridiculous because the guy won't quit. And I use that as like my training wheel, so I got more confident on stage to do things in the first person.
So you're like shooting out just one-liners.
Yeah, yeah. And those are all the ones I learned when I was younger.
But your whole character is who you are is Indian. And do you still do that today?
Yeah, yeah, because that's my point of view, you know. So like Seinfeld says, he's an observation comic. So that's what I am, but I observe things through different eyes than he does.
Like, for example, what would you do now in relation to that character?
Well, that character I've long quit doing, and I started to speak in the first person. I remember Mitzi told me that once. She says, that's funny, but don't keep telling old jokes. So, then I started talking about myself and just the things that I thought were silly or what people didn't understand.
What do you, as far as the world, the state today, I mean, it's changed so drastically in the last 20 years. Has your material changed with it, or do you think you do some what's old and comfortable?
Oh, I see what you mean, greatest hits?
Yeah.
I think everybody's got that in their reserve in case the audience is really bad. But I think when you grow as a person, you grow as a comedian, at least you should. You know, when I see guys do the same thing 30 years ago, I'm going, come on. You know,
some of them do.
Yeah, some of them. I think something must have happened. You talk about that. So as I grew as a person, I you know, I would talk about my kids and my family, whereas when I started, I didn't have that. And then when I found that when I would talk about universal things, it was easier for me to slip into my political things and stuff like that. You know.
So you would say you're more politically orientated?
Well, I think I always was, but when I was younger, I was more blunt because I didn't have a balance. And then sometimes when I would learn how to do this, I'd go up on the early Monday nights and I'd come home and I'd play my recorder. Landisberg suggested that, get a tape recorder. And I thought, wow, tape this stuff?
Oh, that's Steve Landisberg. I haven't seen him around in a long time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I learned a lot from just watching him, even though our styles are different. Was how he went up there and he was real compact, how he got right to the joke, and how he did segues, and he was perfect to watch if you're trying to put a TV set shot together. And I'd watch him every night put that together, so it was all trial and error. But sometimes I'd read a joke, and then I'd think, well, this doesn't work. Is it because they don't understand where I'm coming from or a different experience, or is it too intimidating, or is it just not a funny joke? And then I find usually it's not a funny joke. I think it's something that's funny.
Do you still sit down and write a lot, or you just do you write when you're on stage now, or do you?
Oh, I do both. I do both. That's what Belzer used to call writing on your feet.
Right.
I learned how to do that when I got.
Yeah, that happens when people have enough material.
Yeah.
To do on stage, they have enough material. They can try out their new stuff. They just sort of fit it in.
Yeah.
You know, testing on an audience. Is there some material right now you could share with us that you think people would want, that would make people smile right now?
Boy, I hope anything I do makes them smile. I kind of talk about the times now, how they were similar in some ways when I was in college. And then I talk about how, you know, we used to go on peace marches, and we were so stoned we had to light candles to see where we're going. And the peace march was like in the afternoon. And then I talk about that, and then I segue into Iraq. It's a similar thing. So I call Iraq our 51st state. And then I say all the people there losing their land and their culture and resources, they're going to have to build casinos. And then everybody gets the irony of it. And I noticed when that first was going on, people were afraid to talk about it or address it. And now it's kind of...
That's a good point. A good point you're making, because when something's so kind of a taboo subject,
yeah,
Medians don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, and I think
excuse me.
Stand-up comedy is one of the last bastions of freedom of speech, and not many people are taking advantage of it. They think it's just a license to cuss. But it ain't about that. It's about your point of view and what you're doing with it.
Absolutely.
It is
actually, you get to think, say what you're thinking into the microphone, which is a form that you don't find anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody's walking around trying to be politically correct.
Oh, that makes me so sick.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, it's so insincere. And God. So that's why I always like the Comedy Store. And Mitzi always let me do what I wanted and learn and grow. And it was kind of nice. We both came from the same place back in Wisconsin. But she always was in my corner. And she understood me more than probably any other place I worked, because they always wanted me to modify my stuff or do this. And she let people find the artist within themselves.
And well, I think you're one of her favorites.
Oh, yeah. I feel that. And I'm honored, you know. I just think we go even beyond the store. We've been friends for so long. And I just remember the first time I auditioned there, I'm in line with Michael Keaton, and Mitzi's running the light and watching the comics, and I was a cutoff man. And I was trying to tell her, you know, I was funny last week when you weren't here, but I realized everybody in town does that. So me and Mike went to this club in the Valley, the Bomb, in front of chairs. But the next time I went there in potluck, I lied. I said I'd been on a few times. And I went on. I was just raw. But she liked what I did, and that's just when Westwood came up. So I got a place to learn, and I came at a really good time. I'm real, real blessed by that.
Right. During the middle, late 70s is when the things started to expand, like Robin Williams.
Yeah, I think that was the true golden era. They say the 80s. But the 70s, I think, were more so because it was new.
There really hasn't been an explosion since then with that group, because all those guys are the role models for the comics now. They have somebody to fashion themselves after, and I watched all of that evolve.
Yep.
You know, and you're one of those people that were one of the people that were involved in it. So
yeah.
You know.
I think also when I started, I'd ask some of the pros about advice, and I thought, if I ever learn this, that's what I'm going to do with others if they want to hear it. And it's kind of nice to pass that on if they ask questions.
I have a question for you. I grew up, you know, with a father as a comedian, and back then you'd have to say your dad's like an entertainer, because there was no such thing as a comedian.
Yeah, I can imagine
now,
that, yeah.
What about your kids? I mean, how old are your kids now?
Oh, geez.
Or should I not ask?
Oh, no, you can ask. My oldest son is 26, two daughters, 25 and 21, and an 18-year-old son.
No, because you know how kids always take after their parents?
Yeah.
What are they doing? I mean, are they following in your footsteps in any way?
I think they have the sense of humor, but they went to school longer than me in college, and they don't have those desires, but they always like coming to the Comedy Store, and just from being around it. Especially in the days when Mitzi would let me bring my kids in, you know, it kind of changed as the years went on. But she met them all, and they would watch. And so when they watch somebody on TV or something, it's almost like you. They can tell who's really good and who isn't.
You have to have a, they, yeah, kind of in their blood a little bit. Like,
Yeah.
It's just, I always wondered, you know, about other kids growing up with comics, because my, you know, my dad was always on the road, and he was in Vegas, and
Yeah, that part is hard. That is hard.
You know, and you never, you know, I never saw my father. He's always gone. And
yeah.
So, did you, I mean, you've done a lot. What would you say the highlight of your career is? Because everyone has that highlight.
Well, there's been a lot of highlights. Well, first, the first shot I ever had was Richard Pryor.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other ones that come to mind was when I got to co-write an episode for Roseanne, and she suggested I put my actual family on with me. So I said to Roseanne, well, I stay away from sitcoms or anything with Thanksgiving. She says, well, tell us what you want. We'll do it. And she let me co-write it. And then she suggested bringing my actual family on it. And I thought, that would never, ever happen again. It's like Haley's Comic.
Did you do that? Did you bring them on?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They all got on. They showed every Thanksgiving. She called the episode The Last Thursday in November. And I got to write. And then after that, after the show, she said, my writers suck. You want a job? So she hired me as a writer. And I loved it because she knew I could write stuff, you know, mm-hmm. besides the native stuff I do. She knew that I could think funny. And mm-hmm. I think I always appreciate her.
It's a real talent. Actually,
yeah.
It's almost like you have to train your mind to think in that language.
Yeah.
It's the comedy's a language.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's learning the language.
Yeah, and you know, when you listen to comics talk, they always talk in a shorthand. And you picked it up from being around it, so I could be talking to you about a TV show, and all of a sudden I'm talking about French fries, and there's no in-between, but you kind of jump around with the comic. Or you'll say something really offbeat, and they go, you ought to try that, because sometimes you don't overhear it.
Yeah, and then it's getting to the point as quickly as possible when you're writing comedy.
Yeah, that's right.
Boom.
And I think each time, if you're a true artist, and like Richard Pryor said, and if I can use that word loosely, I think you always keep growing. I saw an interview with Joni Mitchell last week, and she said the true artist starts knowing what he or she does when they get in middle age and even past that. But society wants you to do it all when you're young, so that's the hurdle. And I thought that was amazing. You know,
that is amazing.
Yeah.
You know what? That's a great thought to you know, end this segment of the show, because we have to move on. But
okay,
I
want to ask
great
you
great insight, Charlie.
Yeah.
And hey. You know what? We'll have you on again. Is there
this went fast, Sandy. I love it. And anytime, I'd love it, Sandy.
Absolutely. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, you've been like a young sister to me for a lot of years.
I know. You're part of my family, for
thank
sure.
Thank you.
And
okay.
I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bless you, Sandy. You take care.
Thank you so much. Okay.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, Charlie Hill from the Comedy Store. Coming up next, Dr. Boris Bagdasarov, a little bit about Boris. Let's see, he earned a Ph.D. in human behavior from the U.S. International University in San Diego in 1970. He has spoken and done workshops on past life regression, disincarnates, altered states of consciousness, and a number of other subjects in the area of metaphysics and spiritual thought throughout the U.S. and at Chula University in Bangkok, Thailand, if you can believe that. He taught psychology in England for 2 years. Spent 7 months on a U.S. Navy ship in the Gulf of Tonkin, counseling and teaching psychology while at sea, did the past life regressions in a book entitled Soulmates. You guys remember that book, right? Written by a renowned author and published by Bantam Books. He was an adjunct professor of psychology at Pepperdine University, Chapman University, and National University. So we're really fortunate, and I've known Boris from many years ago, and we're really fortunate to have him on the show. So, Boris, are you online? You're back on with Sandy Seashore. You're listening to Happy Hour, coming to you from San Diego on BBS Radio, and we're back online with Dr. Boris Bagdasarov. And Boris, I gave your introduction right before the break, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
And you're coming to us from Los Angeles.
Right, hoping to move back to San Diego.
Yes, we were talking about that earlier.
Right.
This background of yours is quite extensive. I met you many, many years ago, and you were helping me out with a situation I had. And what would you say, you've got a lot of experience, what would you say your forte is?
Well, originally I was trained, you know, in traditional psychology. Then I got into hypnosis and meditation and altered states. And so probably, I guess we call it spiritual thought or metaphysics.
You know, now, you were doing past life regression before most people were doing it.
Yeah, 1975.
Yeah, you were into that, and you call them shadows.
Well, a shadow is one aspect of the personality. It's the dark side that holds us back from ours. As a matter of fact, that's probably an area I'm more of an expert in.
Yeah, can you describe what a dark shadow is?
Sure. It's okay. That, you know, we have as humans in our consciousness in beta, our logical, rational mind, but when we slide out of that, either through meditation or hypnosis, we get into alpha and then possibly down to theta. And many of us have our spiritual guides and guardian angels are different. We have our inner guides and our external guides. But we have a side of us that's part of our karma, either from a past life or from childhood or even now. It's a little voice inside that says, you'll never make it. You know, don't
try. It's called Patty Cathy.
Yeah, it's a little voice that kind of holds us back. And that's kind of what I've worked on for the last 25 years is getting rid of that kind of thinking. Because thought is powerful, but feelings are even more powerful. And they're feelings. They come from so deep down that we don't even realize we have them.
And they're formed when we're really young. Okay, here's a big question for you.
Okay.
Now, okay, after my years of working with people, I've found out, and correct me, that people are born with a certain character that doesn't change, but the people's belief systems can change because we have these lessons we're supposed to learn. Because that was the only conflict I was having with that thing called The Secret that's out.
Right.
That they never talked about our lessons we're supposed to be learning. Maybe we are supposed to be having the same experience over and over until we get it. So do you agree with me or not?
Well, in a sense that we do have lessons and we come as spirit to continue, you know, expanding our awareness, our growth. And there are those people who are, you know, on a lower level, which is not a negative statement. It just means that they're less evolved. And when I hear the word old soul so often said by psychics, I go, that really doesn't mean anything because Earth plane is only one dimension of reality. There are many other levels. And it's so not so much that we can't change, it's that we come to grow. And we have to confront these, as I call them, shadows, and work through them to become stronger. Just like the bodybuilder, you know, lifts weights to develop the muscles of the body. Perhaps he or she starts out with 50 pounds and 75, then 100, then 200. And each time they lift, the muscles break down, there's pain, and then they grow from that. The muscles grow. So we do, karmically, too. We go through trauma, and hopefully the trauma is part of our learning. Because if life is too easy, we don't learn anything.
Because I think life is just nothing but choices we make. So we make these choices based on something subconscious, do you think, of some lesson?
Oh, yeah, I would say, even myself, I'd say my entire life I've never really, although, you know, I did get a PhD and all, that I never made choices. It was like whichever way that little inner voice blew me, you know, from living in La Jolla to going off to England to teach and coming back for 2 weeks and going to Vietnam, I never chose to do those things. It's just those opportunities came and I went with them. But I think that we really, I hate to use the word have to, but that we have these things, and I've had my lessons in this life too, but so the feelings, we are born, yes, I'll say we're born with a predisposition of a certain kinds of feelings, beliefs, and that's why I moved from traditional psychology to deep clinical hypnosis to get down below the observable behavior and the obvious, like a woman who keeps going after men who are not available. Well, wonderful. So she goes to the therapist and says, keep a journal, and let's talk about taking steps to change your behavior. But that's all logical, rational therapy, which I was trained in. But it goes deeper than that. She goes after the same kinds of situations until she finally learns to say, no, I'm not going to get into another relationship like this with someone who's a user and abuser. And so it's
so
learning rather than continuing to do the same thing
over. So it's like a conscious choice and then it would change?
No, that was the problem with traditional psychotherapy was that it was that we would deal with the behavior and then thinking that the feelings would change. But I believe we have to change the feelings in order to change the behavior.
So, because, you know, you talk about the word feelings, and that's all we take with us when we leave the planet, how we make people feel and how we feel.
Well, we all.
You're right.
We take attitudes with us as well.
And we do, huh?
Yes, the attitudes that, I mean, so often I've seen, even in my own life, that I had feelings going back to my childhood. You know, being raised sort of a blue collar, no one ever finished high school kind of place. And then I end up with a PhD. I said, well, you know, why is that? I never wanted a PhD. I wanted to be a truck driver.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow, you know, life pushed me in that direction. And I kind of just went with it. And I think that we have such deep-seated beliefs, feelings, attitudes that we are not even aware of. Because people, if we were logical, rational beings, the world would be a wonderful place. We wouldn't have murder and rape and killing and all of that silliness that we go through. But it's because we don't understand often. It's deeper than just the behavior you do tomorrow or yesterday, or keeping
it. So it's in our character we're born with.
Exactly. We carry some of these attitudes through with us from past life,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I'm working as a therapist.
Okay. Is it hard to get into people's past lives? I heard really that it's really in the Akashic records, and it's really hard to get to, but people have these, I have to back this up. There's facts. When people go in regression, they give facts out that they wouldn't know otherwise, right? Or speak different languages or this
right.
and that. It's fascinating to know why we incarnated and what our lesson is for the lifetime. I mean, for me, I can't, you know, I'm stuck in the world of comedy. No matter anywhere I try to go, I'm always back to comedy.
But that's your karma. That's something for you to do because you're gifted as well.
Right.
When one has a gift, it's almost, I hate to say, our karmic responsibility to stay with it, even though I know you've had some difficult times.
It gets boring after a while. But when I feel that when I was much younger, I was always trying to figure out what I should do in life, and I always found that if you do what you like the best, then you're following your heart.
Exactly.
And then, you know.
As a matter of fact, even from the very first time I met you, I often thought, my God, this is one woman who is, and you are, you're spiritually aware, and you have so much creativity. I'm not saying this because it's your show, but it's true. And you remember Lewis?
Yes, our dear friend Lewis passed away.
He also felt the same way, that you were an individual with so much creative ability, but it was getting out of your own way and being able to fulfill those abilities.
To channel it in a direction.
Exactly.
Channel it in a direction.
And getting out of your own way, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
As with me, getting out of my own way when I was younger.
When we're younger, you know what, I'm looking back now, it's pretty much our hormones that dictate everything.
That's one side of our reality when I was younger, yes. And that's what I say about getting older now, is I think with my head, that's on my shoulders rather than my fingers. When I was younger,
have you written any books since? I mean, I'm sure you probably got piles of papers, but you were involved with that Soulmate book, and that's when you regressed people?
Yeah, well, I was doing it long before that, but Jeff Stern, who actually became almost like a father figure to me, he said to me, I'm doing a book. We met, it's a long story, I won't go through how we met. It was a whole series of incidents. I was new to L.A., and I met someone, and they said, you've got to meet Jeff Stern. I called Jess, who's a very famous writer, and he invited me to his home immediately. I was there for about 10 minutes. He knew my mother was Irish, from New Jersey. He had a lot of abilities. And then he looked at me and said, would you like to do my past life regressions for a book I'm calling Soulmates? At that point, that was 1975, I really hadn't done past life regressions, but I said, sure. You know, again, that kind of attitude, go with whatever. And I was never trained. I just developed my own system. And as a matter of fact, there was one of the people, Susan Strausberg, who was also a friend of mine. She was in the book. And she always had a fear of claustrophobia, being locked in. And in past life, we took her back to where she was a Christian. And the Romans locked her and a bunch of other Christians into a cave. They blocked it, and she died of suffocation.
Oh.
And so that kind of answered. But it goes much deeper.
So if we have certain fears in life, it's probably based on something we didn't resolve from another time period.
Yes, maybe.
There is no such thing as time, apparently. But, another... That's I don't get that. Oh, by the way, we can take in call-ins, and if anybody wants to call in,
okay.
Talk to the good doctor, toll free 1-877-876-5227. That's in the U.S. You can go right on the BBS radio website and get the phone numbers right off of that. So I just wanted to mention that, Boris, if anybody wants to call
in. Oh, sure. Matter of fact, I was just telling you, so I'll call that today at 3:30, I found one of my really good friends, David Chow, had died. He was a kung fu. He did many, many movies.
Wow.
And
you
then
know,
just
I
a little while
that...
ago, from Rancho Santa Fe, a friend of mine for 39 years.
I got an email this morning that somebody I knew from the Comedy Store died as well.
Yeah, it's like this Dick Scuba, we've been friends for years and years. I talked to him Saturday. I said, yeah, I'm planning on moving back to San Diego. And he said, great, let's get together. And Sunday he died. And he was in great health. He just fell over.
I wonder from what?
He had some blockage in his arteries to the heart.
The old blockage.
Yeah.
It's kind of creepy because you can't tell, but, you know, I guess if you drink lots of water and get lots of sleep, you might be better tuned into your body that way.
Yeah, that helps. It's kind of just, and you know, some people say we have predestination, and we also have free will, you know, and it's that line between destination and free will that we work with. I was supposed to go for surgery 4 weeks ago, and I just thought for a hip replacement. I suddenly had a feeling, and I made plans, and I'm not afraid of death, but I made all my arrangements just in case. And I went to see my old interns. He said, oh, my God. He looked at the pre-op. He said, no, they canceled. And he said, you would have died on the table. And then he sent me to an endocrinologist who said, you never would have come out of anesthesia.
Why?
Well, because I had my thyroid had gone out of control, and I had heart arrhythmia.
And
yet I'm an athlete. You know, I've been sick all my life. And so I didn't, and now I'm still alive. You know, but had I not taken that next step, like my friend Dick, had he gone in and been tested, he might not have died. That's what I'm saying. You know, this whole thing of predestination is so confusing for people. But I do believe we have free will that can override. It's not the old Calvinistic style of predestination. It's just saying that. You know, people say, well, was this time to go? Well, in a sense, but it would have been my time to go had I not used my cognitive and my gut feelings and said, let's get another opinion about this.
That's a big key. It's like me going to the dentist. I must have been to like 20, 30 dentists in my life just interviewing. By the way, you know, dentistry is just like, it just could be horrific for people if you don't have the right dentist.
Everybody's afraid of dentists.
Well, you know, that was one of my biggest fears in life, and I am completely over it. I found a dentist that
great.
I just love. And he can do whatever he wants now.
Oh,
so,
that's super.
But it took me, you know, a lifetime to find him. And now I feel completely at ease, and I have no fear, and we just laugh. We just joke and laugh and have so much fun. I look forward to going in.
Oh, yeah. No, it's right.
But I'm just saying, you know, once you get over your fear, because a lot of people have fear.
Well, that's it. That's the shadow.
Right? And you go and you just face it, and what's the big deal? Because these are just our rental units. They're carriages, and they hold a lot. And, you know, I don't think we ever were programmed to handle stress. Our bodies weren't, you know, so manifest in different areas.
Oh, sure.
And living today, wouldn't you say it's 10 times more stressful than when you grew up?
Oh, yeah. You know, I grew up on a little farm raised by my grandparents.
Isn't that
you know, they
wonderful?
Probably had their problems, too, but I never knew it. I was just a little kid growing up on a farm in New Jersey.
People have to have, like, three jobs now.
Oh, it's so difficult now. And, you know, I would not want to have children at this point in history with the world.
Yeah, a lot of people are not choosing to have any. They
yeah, it's a very heavy karmic. I mean, a dark karmic period that we're in right now of learning. And
can you explain that? Why that is?
Well,
I think astrologically they talk about end of cycles, and you know we've heard 10 different takes on it. You know, so you know we've heard about everything we can. We have so much information out there. I always like to hear something new and fresh.
Well,
you know,
I heard something very, as a matter of fact, it was our friend Lewis who said this, the philosopher. He said, Earth also has karma. And I thought that was interesting. I had never heard that before, nor have I heard it since, except from this very wise, elderly man we knew.
Yeah, Lewis was my teacher for like 15 years.
I know.
He was my mother, my father. He helped raise me, and he passed away this February. So
I was trying to remember, Sandra. Was it he who introduced you to me or me who introduced you to him?
I think
I introduced him to you to him.
Yes, you introduced me to him.
Right, yeah, okay. That
yes,
goes back
you did.
A lot of years.
You were in the early years of metaphysics.
Right.
People weren't, you know, there wasn't that many people, you know.
Well, all my friends in San Diego thought I was bonkers. I was talking about spirit guides and guardian angels in 1974.
Uh-huh.
And now my friends in San Diego, when I go down, boy, what's the difference between internal guides and external guides, you know, and that sort of thing. But in 1974, they all thought I was nuts, you know. And I wasn't so sure. No, I knew I wasn't, you know. I had to take all those psychological tests in graduate school.
But then I thought I was nuts until I came across you and Lewis.
Yeah.
You guys helped me out so much. Like, what are these voices going on? No, it's not schizophrenia. It's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Where do you see, this is kind of a general question.
I'll see.
But, you know, a lot of people are leaving the planet. You know, I always say the Earth is like an airport, departures and arrivals daily. And, you know, a lot of people are leaving right now. What do you think is going on metaphysically on the planet? Science-wise, there's things you can explain the sunspots and this and that, but we picked this particular time to incarnate.
Right.
So what do you think our lessons are here?
Well, I think part of it is that we came here, and see, a lot of people think the Earth plane is the only place where souls come, but there are many, many other dimensions. I did a workshop up in Encino years ago to about 60 psychics and astrologers, and there was a wonderful black woman from Jamaica, and she was just the kind of woman you want to have to put your arms around you and hug you. She was just total warmth. And I hypnotized her, and her inner mind said this was her first time on Earth plane. And everybody was upset with me. And I said, well, I didn't say that. That was her inner mind. Then I had a nice little minister. And this is the thing about ritual that I wonder about. She was a minister, cute little 80-year-old, white-haired, blue-eyed gal. And so, in the course of hypnotizing her, the voice came out of her throat and said, leave me alone. And I went, oh, God, shadow. And I did the white prayer that people talk about all the time with the ritual. And his voice said, F you and F the white prayer. And I went, well, so much for ritual. You know, and I tell people, don't ever, like with ghosts, I've done houses all over the country. Don't ever threaten a ghost. I mean, don't threaten with Jesus because maybe it's a Muslim, you know.
Oh, that's pretty
And funny. I think that we come here, yeah, and you're right, we come here to learn. And right now it's a difficult period. But I think that when we leave here, Earth is only a stepping stone. You know, life here, we have physical bodies. When we leave, we have perfect spiritual bodies.
And
I know my grandfather's been around me for years as as what some people would call a guardian angel. And and I am working on a book, which I'm not going to throw the name out because my belief is when you have a creative idea and you put it out into the universe, someone else might pick it up.
Absolutely.
But it's about my journey from being a former Marine Recon to talking with ghosts and spirits and doing houses. I've done a few houses here in L.A. I used to go around the country clearing houses, and I've done production studios up here. For me, a guy from New Jersey, half Irish, half Russian, Catholic, I mean, all this stuff that I'm in, and a former Marine, I'm going, oh, my God, I would have thought I was crazy, too. You know? But, yeah, I think Earth plane right now, it's going through a heavy time. But also, you know, sometimes we feel badly. We see these little children starving in Africa, and my understanding of that is that they're new souls. They come in for a short period of time just to experience Earth plane at that level. And then eventually they come back, and eventually they're past that kind of deprivation. I mean, it's terrible.
And the good news is when we get to the other side, we don't have to worry about mortgage payments and rent.
Right, exactly.
And haircuts.
Yeah, and we have a perfect body. No more pain, no more hurt. We have
you know, people are going through depressions and
it's a tough time now.
Terribly
the economy too.
Terrible things right now, and there's some it's important to keep a sense of humor, because that's what gets you through this stuff. And one thing Lewis taught me, he taught me one word, and it took him 15 years for it to sink in. It's called trust.
Yes,
it's like trust when things are going on. You just trust it. It's like, why do you have to keep going through the same thing over and over? Well, trust it. And then you thank the experience, you know, and move on.
And
crack a joke and enlighten, you know. I think people become really enlightened when they have a sense of humor.
Humor,
I think that's
is
enlightenment. I think because, you know, I was a Buddhist for 19 years, and I'd sit there and chant and chant and try, you know, working towards my enlightenment. And I realized I never got there. After 19 years, you'd think you'd get there, right? We never got there. What? It's just a state of mind.
It is. Now, the
right?
chant you did, was that that Haradori or whatever it is?
Oh, I don't want to say.
Yeah, okay, I know what it was. I mean, you never talked to me about it. That, to me, was a breakoff from true Buddhism. It was a Japanese modern.
It's like a cult thing.
Yeah. And I knew hundreds, I had, over the years, I've known so many people. And I found that to be sort of a place where they stopped. They did not move beyond. Because
yeah, chanting
is
it,
only
it,
to
it was
get
great
into
for, your... Yeah, it was great for about 6 months. But after
yeah, exactly.
that, that's
feels
the end
good,
of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing was, you know, a life to people search their lifetime for enlightenment.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think they're, you know, and I don't think the word happy, I don't think that's a goal because that's an emotion and that's fleeting. I think the word is joy.
Yeah.
Just finding the joy in things and finding that, you know, that enlightenment. And I've been looking for it all my life and I just realized that it's in just every step you take.
Yeah, and it comes
state of mind.
Yes, and chanting is only to put, really to put you into an altered state is all it really does. You know, it's like I was raised Catholic and I remember... I'd go to midnight mass, Christmas, you know.
Yeah.
And I never remembered a thing. I suddenly realized after all these years when I got into altered states of consciousness that they were hypnotizing us. You sit there, there are candles.
Brainwashing.
Clicking, channeling, say call, say call, say call. And, and I was actually, we were all hypnotized. That's what it was. We all went into an altered state. It was like we all took a couple of totes on some heavy marijuana or something.
Well, you know, it's like that, you know, we all know by now religion is man-made, and people have their belief systems, and they're not going to change them, you know,
because that keeps
them together mentally.
Right.
But to expand into other possibilities, well, you know, there's truth in everything, like Lewis would say, there's truth into everything. I mean, but, you know, I just think that it's we have to just, you know, evolve our thinking into having an open, more an open mind. Right now, the UFO thing's becoming public, and people
yeah,
are going,
after all these years.
Yeah, finally, hello, they're real.
Oh yeah.
You know, and so the mainstream media picked it up finally, but they're still brushing under the rug because it's either fear or it's like I don't want to admit it because I'm going to ruin my career.
Yeah,
still.
Well, there's so much you know that government has kind of blocked, and I mean the whole thing with Kennedy's assassination. Why do you put something into a locked file for 50 years? I mean, that never made sense to me.
I think the public were sick of it already.
Yeah, we are.
Right?
I think we're all getting
out on
tired of government control, especially the last few years.
Well, it's going to get worse. That's what I'm seeing.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember, God, I hate to say it, 1956, my professor said, when people are afraid for security, they will give up their individual freedoms. And that's what we're doing.
You think there's like a big conspiracy out there?
Oh, I don't. You know, the word conspiracy. I just think there's a lot of crookedness. I think that I mean, I love my country, but I'm not too crazy about our government and the way they do things. You know, it's one blunder after another, and I don't know. I wish we could get some really bright people running for government.
They're all murdered or
yeah, the good ones never make
done
it.
Done away with.
Yeah, so I talked to a lot of my friends about this, and it seems like a shame, but people are kind of saying that, you know, I don't even want to deal with it. I don't want to think mm-hmm. about it, which is unfortunate. See, we all were angry at the Germans for what Hitler did. But, you know, I don't think the average German was really into all that. They had no power. They had no power.
That's true.
The government ran them. And,
mm-hmm.
and like in Australia, they took away the ability of people to have a weapon to protect their home, and the crime rate went up by 50 or 60%.
Mm-hmm.
And now our Congress is trying to say that no American can have, and I'm not a pro-gun, anti-gun, but can have a weapon to protect themselves. The only people that have weapons in Australia are the crooks and the thieves. And our government is this whole liberal. I mean, I'm not conservative, I'm not liberal.
It's very confusing. I think we just need to follow our hearts because, I mean, we have no control over any of that stuff.
Yeah. And
I think that's what's so sad about it.
Because what that means is that we're turning ourselves over to the system.
That's kind of depressing to talk about this culture.
You know, I decided that if I win the lottery or if my book makes a lot of money, I am going to restart the Gray Panthers. I thought that was a great movement because so many of us now are over 50 in this country, but we have no power. We have ARP, which is basically just a con artist company to sell insurance. That's why ARP was started. You know, they care a damn about anything except selling their insurance policies. And so we really don't have any spokespeople. We have no power.
Well, everybody's too busy just trying to survive.
Exactly. And right now,
they just watch TV at night.
So if we look at this whole system from a spiritual or metaphysical aspect, we go, whoa, why is Earth going through this? This is a lot of heavy stuff we're going through. People losing their homes, the forest fires, people up in Malibu, they burn, they build, rebuild. But, taking it back, from the hardcore reality of the everyday political world we live in, I think the spiritual, and I think you said something earlier about humor. I one of the things I do now is I work for a company up here, in L.A., called Neptune Society. And I go out and I explain cremation to people, I do their legal paperwork. And in the course of doing it, we laugh. And when it's all over, people look at me and say, God, boy, this is something we really don't want to think about, dying and being cremated, but it was so much fun. Because when I work with people, we laugh, we joke, we have a cup of tea together, and sometimes I even tell them jokes. If they're Catholics, I tell them Catholic jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what it's all about. If we can approach life with a smile, because it's so easy to be depressed.
People making wills is something that they don't even want to think about.
Exactly.
That's a hard subject.
And like durable power of attorney for health care, I explain to everyone, it's really important because, I made my plans 14 years ago, not that I'm going to die. I didn't want to leave it to other people to have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I see situations.
That's a lot. It's very expensive, too. A lot of people are leaving the planet.
And people are vulnerable. You just lost your husband, and men don't like to deal with issues, as you're probably aware, and I was as a marriage counselor for years, that men want to put everything off till tomorrow. I don't want to talk about that. I'm going to live forever, And it's the women often who say, but look, you're not doing this for you. You're doing this for me or something. But they don't want to hear it. That's been another interesting phenomenon after all those years.
It's part of that, human spirits. Like there's things we can't deal with. We can't deal with, our dental or doctor or emotional issues.
Yeah, we were never trained as men to share feelings. You didn't talk about feelings.
Men are coming around.
But the reality is that feelings and communication between a husband and a wife or friends is really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
Do
you have any, we have to bring you back on again, because we're all at the top of the hour.
Okay.
It's happy hour. Well, we still have a few minutes, I think.
But
I just wanted to tell everyone that, to lighten up, really. It's not all that bad. Think about what's the most important thing in life.
When you feel sorry for yourself, look around at some other people.
A dog.
It's a tough life. If you're healthy and you got a body, decent body, not a great body, and your mind is okay and you don't have to take medication so you can feel okay to wake up in the morning, you got a pretty good life. Every morning I wake up, I look out of my bedroom window, I look out over the city. I have a really neat suite up on the hills here. And I go to my living room, I put my little Italian coffee maker on, I make coffee, I pet my cats, I feed them, clean their litter. I look out over the city from my living room, and I go to my office, fire up the computer, and I look out. And it's the only thing that's holding me in L.A. is I have a wonderful place to live. But I think San Diego is so much more of a spiritual, wonderful place. I call L.A. the place where dreams come to die. All these poor kids from all over the world, point their comma maybe to learn, but you're a pom-pom girl in Nebraska, so you're so pretty you should be an actress. They come out here with their life savings, and they get ripped off.
That's the truth, and they work
as a waitress. It's a tough town. On the news, they just said that from Long Beach to L.A. is one of the most depressed people being depressed on the West Coast.
I believe that.
Yeah.
San Diego's surrounded by water.
Oh, it's wonderful.
And we don't have industry here, so it's really conducive to just a relaxing environment.
Oh, I can hardly wait to move back there.
I can hardly wait for you to move here, too.
Yeah, that'll be super. Yeah, I love San Diego. I've lived here for 23 years. I lived there for 12 working on my master's at San Diego State and then my PhD.
Well, you're coming
back
home.
I still have more friends from San Diego in those 12 years than 24 years I've moved to L.A. I meet thousands of people because I did over 250 television shows up here on metaphysics and
stuff
like that, on public access.
Wow.
And I've done workshops and seminars and been in practice.
Are you going to do some of that over here?
Yeah, I think when I get back to San Diego, I'm gonna get active. I love Point Loma. That's my. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. There's something about Point Loma. I just love it there. It's maybe I lived there in a past life or something.
I don't know. It's just we get into these areas. I like Bay Park. I always wind up in Bay Park.
Yeah, that's.
But I just wanted to let everyone know. Do you have a website or anything?
Yeah, it's Dr. Dr. Boris, B-O-R-I-S, B like boy, at yahoo.com.
Oh, okay, that's your email. I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. And my website, sandyshore.com, S-A-N-D-I-S-H-O-R-E. It should be up by tomorrow. We're redesigning it. Thank you, Marion M. Thomas, for working on it. And I'll see you guys, talk to you guys next week. Have a wonderful week, and don't stress about anything. It's not worth it. You know, because you can't take it all with you. So,
right.
Have a great evening, everybody. Thank you, Boris. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank
Hill,
you, Sandy.
Tommy.
It was so nice to connect again. I'm so pleased with that. After all these years, yeah.
I know. And I'll see you when you get down here.
That's a deal.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody.
Okay. Bye-bye.